Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo. Along with Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists, it is my pleasure to introduce you to Music at Menlo's 2010 season, Maps and Legends. In 2004, the festival's second season, we embarked on a musical odyssey with stops in five singular musical regions. This season, we expand on that journey to explore music from a spectrum of remarkable times and places, from the rich musical traditions of Vienna, England, and Spain, to Dvorak's America, 1920s Paris, and beyond. Maps and Legends will offer listeners many layers of context in which to engage with a broad spectrum of great music. This season's audio notes are designed to illuminate some of these layers. Over the course of this summer's concerts, encounters, and other festival events, we'll only continue to discover more of the innumerable connections that make the chamber music literature so rich. This disc juxtaposes two of this summer's concert programs, The English Voice and Vienna. Both programs celebrate a distinguished musical heritage, but the musical traditions of England and Vienna have taken dramatically different courses. For nearly two centuries, from the dawn of the classical period in the early 1700s until around the outbreak of the First World War, Vienna was, without question, the epicenter of the musical world. The city was a cauldron of innovation, fostering the development of the classical style, romanticism, and the early 20th century avant-garde. Vienna fueled the imaginations of some of Western music's greatest composers, from Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven to Johannes Brahms and Arnold Schoenberg. During this time, while Vienna flourished, England fell silent. The transition from the Baroque to the classical period had extinguished the English voice. England's musical landscape was primarily populated by expatriate composers like Haydn and Felix Mendelssohn. That all changed when an intrepid generation of English composers at the turn of the 20th century spearheaded a musical renaissance, and England shed its label of a land without music. Music at Menlo's second and third concert programs this summer feature some of the finest masterpieces in the chamber music repertoire. Beethoven's Serioso Quartet, Brahms' String Sextet, Opus 36, Edward Elgar's thrilling piano quintet, and more, heard in the context of the evolution of two fascinating cultural histories.
This is music by the English composer Henry Purcell. Born in 1659, Purcell to this day is recognized as one of England's greatest composers. Indeed, Purcell ranks among the most important composers of the Baroque period in general, but his importance to England's musical identity in particular constitutes a significant part of his legacy. He is the patriarch of English music, occupying a similar place in that country's musical heritage as, say, Charles Ives in the United States. But following Purcell's death in 1695, English musical culture fell dormant. Aside from contributions by foreign-born visiting composers, like George Frideric Handel and Joseph Haydn, the English musical voice remained silent for two centuries. Throughout the classical and romantic eras, German music dominated, while the musical cultures of Italy, France, Eastern Europe, and Russia likewise flourished. It wasn't until the British composer Edward Elgar unveiled his Enigma variations in 1896 that England's composers reawakened to the richness of their own musical heritage. In the first three decades of the 20th century, composers like Elgar, Ralph Vaughan Williams, William Walton, and others became compelled to cultivate a distinct national identity and worked to revitalize England's musical landscape. Encounter leader Bruce Adolph.
England, at the turn of the last century, between the 19th century and the 20th century, was called by many people a land without music. There was a strong belief that until the time of Mendelssohn, the mid to late 19th century, that England had been without a significant composer since Purcell. And there's a lot of truth to that. The feeling that England had to prove itself musically was very real. It wasn't invented by these composers. They felt it a burden that they had to deal with. During World War I and after, which is when the music we're talking about was composed, there was a definite feeling in England, among all the artists, of competition with Europe, a sense of inferiority that they wanted to overcome. And of course, the composers we're highlighting are those who did overcome that.
Edward Elgar led the quest of England's composers to discover and define the essence of their musical culture. Born in 1857, Elgar combined the influence of his continental Romantic contemporaries with his own British consciousness to develop a distinct compositional language.
He was, in many ways, the first truly internationally great composer of that time to come from England, and his music was not clearly based on English anything. It was just Elgar reacting to the music he loved of Europe. It reacted to the music of Brahms, the music of Strauss, and of course, everything that came before it. And primarily, it was a reaction to German music. But he also had in his temperament something uniquely English that had to do with, as he himself put it, the climate and the literature and the history of England. It's hard to put your finger on what that is. When you hear music of Elgar, if you don't know what it is, and you're familiar with German music, you might first think it's Brahms, but it isn't, and you can tell there's something is different, and that something is Elgar.
We'll return later to Elgar, who appears at the end of this program. The concert actually begins with music by one of Elgar's cultural heirs, and arguably the greatest composer to come out of England in the 20th century, Benjamin Britten. Britten lived from 1913 to 1976. He was, during his lifetime, and remains today, a cherished English cultural icon. Britten cultivated a uniquely personal and deeply expressive compositional language, while still adhering to certain musical principles of the past. In a time when composers experimented with 12-tone structures and the dissolution of traditional harmony, Britten combined directly communicative tonalities with sophisticated formal structures. Like his forebears, Britten was conscious of creating a distinctly English style. One thing that distinguished him somewhat from his contemporaries, however, was his fervent admiration, and in a way his emulation, of the music of Henry Purcell. Britten sought to capture what he identified in Purcell's music as a synthesis of, quote, clarity, brilliance, tenderness, and strangeness, end quote. Britten's extensive contribution to the vocal repertoire represents one of his greatest musical achievements. His oeuvre includes numerous operas, some of which, like Peter Grimes, Billy Budd, A Midsummer Night's Dream, and Death in Venice, to name a few, are recognized among the standard-bearers of 20th century opera. In addition, he composed much choral music, large-scale vocal orchestral works like his magnum opus War Requiem, and also numerous song cycles. Our program begins with one of Britten's most sublimely beautiful essays in this genre, A Charm of Lullabies.
Sleep, sleep, beauty bright, dreaming o'er the joys of night. Sleep, sleep.
The program continues with the piano quartet of Sir William Walton.
I don't know how serious this is, but sometimes I think that Walton suffers because he's Sir William Walton.
Encounter leader Bruce Adolph.
The sound of his name and the sir give the completely wrong impression of what this guy was like, because he was a great entertainer, and his music is not aspiring even to be part of the canon of the great literature of England at all. He's an entertainer, and he brings everything he knows about music into every piece.
Born in the town of Oldham near Manchester in 1902, William Walton absorbed a wide array of musical innovations throughout his formative artistic years. Although his foundation was decidedly English, springing primarily from his boyhood years as a chorister at Christ Church Cathedral, he was equally fascinated by composers ranging from Maurice Ravel and Igor Stravinsky to George Gershwin, as he was by Elgar and his own English contemporaries.
Walton was inspired by everything, and his music is a celebration of just about every kind of music that he heard, which is why you get very jazzy rhythms and dissonances that are Schoenbergian at the same time. The sense of George Gershwin and Harold Arlen meets Arnold Schoenberg and Elgar and Brahms and Strauss, and they're all together having a big party. But yet it's not an eclectic mess. It fits together because he would pull it all together and give you something worth the ticket price, so to speak.
Walton composed his piano quartet between 1918 and 1919, when he was only 16 years old. Though he revised it prior to its publication in 1924, and then a second time when he was in his 70s, the quartet would retain the teenage Walton's youthful vigor.
The piano quartet, which is his first major work, it's an amazing debut. That piece has jazz piano. The chords and some of the tunes in it sound like they could be by Harold Arlen or Jerome Kern or George Gershwin. At the same time, as the forms are classical, there's very rigorous counterpoint, even a fugue. There's romantic harmony. There are some experimental harmonies that are unique to the piece. He was using non-functioning chords that are not part of the jazz world, not part of the classical world, not part of the romantic world. A real modern composer finding a sound for a particular thought. The opening of the piano quartet could be by Vaughan Williams. It's modal, and it sounds like it's influenced by both British folk music and Ravel. But as it goes on, the first movement becomes more French and more Ravel, and eventually more dissonant and a little more adventurous. The third movement is the one where I really hear his fascination with the most sophisticated kind of popular songwriting of the time. And that was an era where popular song was being written in America by some composers of very high quality whose understanding of harmony was equal to what we call a classical composer's understanding of harmony. Jerome Kern and Harold Arlen and people like that wrote songs with sophisticated modulations, very particular voicings, interesting use of resonance in their chord spacing. And so it's natural to find someone like Ravel fascinated by Gershwin, and Gershwin fascinated by Ravel, and Walton fascinated by all these people.
Thank you.
in the last movement of the Walton, aside from the Gershwin, Jerome Kern jazz pianist influence, there's also references to the Ravel piano trio.
Just a quick interjection here to let you know about another one of our concerts this summer, and I swear to you, Bruce did not know this when I interviewed him, but the Ravel piano trio will also be presented at the festival this summer on our sixth concert program, Spanish Inspirations. A complete discussion of the Ravel piano trio appears on our first Audio Notes disc this season.
There's also references to the Ravel piano trio. There's a bass line that just won't let go in a way that is very similar to some of the things Ravel does in his piano trio. And I think there's a fun cycle here, maybe a circle of influence, which is Ravel influenced by American popular music, especially jazz, and Gershwin wanting to study with Ravel, who told him he should study with him instead, that it was better the other way around. But Ravel being interested in Gershwin, Gershwin being interested in Ravel, and Walton being interested in both Ravel and popular American song. And there's a cross-fertilization of these things. And it was good that Walton did that, because Walton, by his openness to both American jazz and French music, was able to create an English version of that.
In 1917, while Europe was engulfed in the First World War, Edward Elgar retreated from London to the English countryside. He and his wife rented a cottage in Sussex, where they could enjoy some measure of escape from the war's centrality to daily life. The change in scenery rejuvenated Elgar, as he immediately set to work on a number of chamber works, first a string quartet, then a violin sonata. On the very day that he completed the sonata, September 15, 1918, he began what would be arguably his finest contribution to the chamber music literature, the Piano Quintet in A Minor, Opus 84. Not only did leaving the city spark Elgar's creativity, the wooded setting itself had a direct bearing on the music.
He was writing about the twisted, scary trees outside his window in the house he had rented with his wife for the summer of 1917.
Bruce Adolph.
They were renting a house called Brinkwell's. It's well known that outside that area, there were these very twisted, ghostly trees that probably had been struck by lightning. And there was a story that was told by a friend of Elgar's, a violinist named Reed. Reed said that there was a legend that Spanish monks who were practicing black magic had been turned into trees. So Elgar, in the opening of the piano quintet, is kind of writing a ghost story. And it really sounds like one. You have this Gregorian chant in the piano, and then the strings and the bass of the piano are whispering twisted trees that are kind of haunting the Gregorian chant. Now, what's interesting is that Reed never heard that legend from anybody. He said it was a legend, but in fact, there was no such legend, and Spanish monks never came anywhere near England. But what he was referring to was a story told by Elgar's friend, Algernon Blackwood, which is a very good name for someone who's making up a story about the woods. Algernon Blackwood said the story about the monks. He made that up and told it to Elgar, and it became something that for a while, without the help of some research, people thought that this was a legend of that area, but there's no such legend at all. After a little while, this ghostly whispering of the twisted monk trees disappears, and we get some more chromatic, typically romantic-sounding music that reminds you a little bit of Wagner, but primarily, again, of Brahms.
a very distinct sound to the writing.
Pianist Enon Barnaton.
There's the harmonies, the lushness of the string sound, the way it's crafted. One of the things that distinguished Brahms is the way that he married the form and the expression, the way that he was able to craft music in such beautifully architectural and thematic terms, but also write music that was so immediately emotionally accessible and emotionally expressive. So when you listen to a piece of Brahms, or to that extent Elgar or the Elgar Quintet, the first impression that you have is how beautiful and emotional and expressive the music is. But also when you listen a little bit more closely, you can find the craft inside there, how themes are organized, how certain lines go in opposite directions, for example, how things come back, how the music is framed to a certain extent, things that appear episodically. And it's just a general sense that he takes Brahms and the Germanic tradition as a role model. It's something to aspire to, but injects very much his own expressive and emotional content.
But the twisted tree motif comes back and haunts the first movement throughout, and it's very powerful. I think the slow movement is the most beautiful thing Elgar ever wrote. I mean, it's absolutely exquisite. The harmonic writing relates to Brahms, but it's unique, and it's completely Elgar's own. And you hear gestures that you never hear in any of the music that he could possibly be accused of learning from. It has a rich sonic opulence that is a trademark of Elgar. It has a depth and a maturity and a sense of space that becomes associated with British music because of Elgar. What we don't expect is that the more urgent sounding chromatic music that is the opposite of the twisted tree music comes back in the second movement and at the opening of the third movement. So he ties this all together in a cyclical nature, and there's a sense of a big story being told, which you could say that many classical forms have the sense of a story, but here the feeling of a tale is very palpable.
almost in a way that Wagner uses leitmotifs, that he uses specific themes and specific sounds to indicate certain moods or certain characters, and throughout the piece would reintroduce them to take the listener back. And I think Elgar does the same thing here. He brings back that spooky or yearning beginning and uses that to frame other parts of the piece. The other thing that's very obvious about the piece is how personal it is. Elgar pours out his emotions in such an intense way that sometimes it's almost hard to follow that structural sense that I was talking about, because it also has a meandering feeling to it. The way that a person would talk, or the way that a person would tell a story in an emotional way, where it doesn't always seem as organized as a structured lecture or an essay, but you get the feeling that he's pouring out his emotions and they come out as they happen, even though there is that sense of underlying structure.
To hear more of my conversations with Bruce Adolph and Enon Barnaton about Edward Elgar and the Music of England, please visit us online at www.musicatmenlo.org/multimedia and click on Audio Notes Outtakes. This is a new feature we're offering this season. Audio Notes Outtakes includes more insights into the music from this summer's festival artists that we couldn't fit onto these discs, so please check it out. Again, that's online at www.musicatmenlo.org/multimedia. Click on Audio Notes Outtakes.